Press. I'm Spencer Dobson.
And I'm Corey Heidelberger. On today's program, quick hits on Trump Care Down Medicaid Up, Christy Nolan School Lunch, the New York Times visits Mount Rushmore, our in-depth discussion of immigration and South Dakota's workforce shortage, plus our exclusive interview with legislator Representative Drew Dennert.
All right, Corey. Well, first of all, how are you doing?
Hey, I'm doing great. We've got all sorts of good stuff to talk about, and it's springtime outside.
Finally, it's fantastic. Before we get going, if you have a couple of bucks and you're a listener and you like the show, anything you can put in the tip jar, we greatly appreciate it. If you're a Republican or somebody on the right and you enjoy hating this show, we do need your money to continue to make things that you don't like.
And we just invested in a new server plan. I can tell you it's been up and humming for 6 days.
Fantastic.
Your contributions to the tip jar will help us keep that server humming.
Very nice. And we have we've got someone from the right for our interview today, correct?
Yes, Drew Dennert, good local Republican. He's been involved in Republican politics for much of his young life. He is the youngest legislator in South Dakota right now.
How old is he?
He is, I believe he's 21.
21?
21. Old enough to drink, and you need a good drink to survive the legislature, I hear.
That's very young. I'm looking forward to hearing this. At 21, a lot of people don't know their knees from their elbows,
well,
I guess would be the nice way to put that. But he seems to have it together, so I'm looking forward to hearing what he has to say.
I am too. Drew knows a lot about legislation. We'll pick his brain on this year's session.
Sounds good. Well, shall we get to it?
Let's go.
All right. This is our first quick topic. So the ACA repeal failed.
Woohoo!
And I called Christy Nome's office on the day of the ACA repeal.
How was Christy feeling that day?
You know, I called them right when Trump got into office about a number of things. And they were like, hi, this is Christy Nome's office. Thanks for calling in. What can we do for you? And when I called this time, the guy was like, yes. I just wanted to let Christy Nome say I'm against the appeal of the Affordable Care Act. He's like, noted. And then he took my information. It's like, oh, rough day, huh?
Reality sets in Washington.
And now that they're not repealing the Affordable Care Act, it is time to expand Medicare, yes?
Well, or Medicaid.
Medicaid. Then we have to discuss the difference between the two.
That's important. To be clear, and everybody mixes these up at some point.
Right.
Medicaid is the program for helping low-income people.
Right.
Afford health insurance.
And our governor supports the expansion of it, and you can do it in ACA.
Right. We've got Medicaid now for a certain group of low-income people.
Right.
The Affordable Care Act says states can expand coverage to include people who make a little bit more than poverty, single working individuals, that kind of thing.
And I have the specifics. Okay, you qualify for Medicaid based on income, household size, disability, family status, and other factors. Eligibility rules differ between states. Now, if they expand it, what it means is you can qualify based on your income alone. So if your household income is below 133% of the federal poverty level, you qualify. So that just makes it easier for people to get on. You don't need to, you know, you don't need a disability. You don't need all these other check marks. And so it brings in a lot more people into that pool.
Right. A lot more. Like the standard number we have in South Dakota is
right.
50,000 more South Dakotans who don't have affordable insurance right,
right
now and who thus are delaying care, not getting health care, thus ending up sicker, poorer, and not working as much. 50,000 people could get affordable coverage and be able to go to the doctor for what ails them.
And two important facts on this. One, it'll have zero impact on the budget.
Oh, I amend that. It'll have a positive impact on the budget.
Oh, no kidding.
The numbers we saw last year were, yeah, we'd spend money to do the Medicaid expansion, mm-hmm. but the cool trick Governor Dugard came up with would have the federal government take on more of our Indian Health Services costs.
Oh, nice.
And when they broke this down, they said ultimately it becomes a net plus for the budget.
And this one is for you, Dugard. Am I saying that right?
Dugard.
Governors that expand Medicaid tend to get reelected.
At least we've seen that. And this is in the Republican states.
There
are Republican governors in other states. Not one Republican governor who's done the straight-up Medicaid expansion plan has either lost his next election or seen his party lose the next election.
However,
if there are a couple of Republican governors who have said, nah, we don't want to do it, or nah, we're going to do only a light version of it, they've gotten beaten by Democrats, I believe,
what
in Pennsylvania, North Carolina. So if any Republicans out there are worried about the politics of accepting something that says Obama on it,
right.
Medicaid expansion is not the thing that will hurt you. People,
right.
when they get Medicaid expansion, the states go, eh, this is a good idea.
And this is people's health, so quit screwing around and quit towing the party line for the sake of towing the party line. You've got the House, you've got the Senate, you've got the presidency. It's time to get things done right on a national level. They've got all of those things. And now, and locally, South Dakota is pretty much run by Republicans.
Right.
So get some results.
We could cover 50,000 people at pretty much no cost to South Dakota.
And on a side note, Bernie Sanders is proposing Medicare for all, which he has proposed in the past. I don't know if we should go into that right now because I didn't do any homework on it other than to read a couple of articles. But those I'm bringing this up to tell you that those two, not you, to tell the listener that Bernie Sanders' Medicare for all and Medicaid expansion are not the same thing.
Right. Those are different things. Medicare, the system that right now covers our senior citizens because they're too expensive for the private sector to insure, that's a separate program. And what we've heard, Bernie Sanders says this, and Rick Wyland, our friend who ran for Senate in 2014, called for this, basically saying, let's make Medicare available to everybody who wants to buy in, regardless of age. Interesting spin on the idea of a public option or ultimately a single payer, maybe.
Well, and that's something I just read before I came here, was that when you call it Medicare for all, people love it. And when you call it single payer, people hate it.
So but it'd be the same thing.
We really need to work on our education system if that's how people are making their choices. I think that's we're uncovering an inherent flaw in our thought process. But let's move on to the next topic.
You bet.
School lunch programs. Christy Noem wants to, well, okay, explain. She was asked a question.
Yeah, Christy held a town hall. Oh my
right.
gosh. Actually,
was
met
it,
with
is this the one with the small town hall that?
This was, yeah, it was in Watertown. They said they couldn't find a good place to have it, so they held it in a room that only held 50 people at the police station.
Right.
It wasn't a jail cell, but the thought may have crossed their minds. But yeah, so they held a town hall a couple weekends ago, and a citizen asked Christy about how the Trump budget cuts would affect South Dakota and, like, education. Christy turned her response around. It was just blatant evasion.
It's known as a pivot.
Yes, pivot. Thank you. That's the term of art for this. Christy pivoted to complaining about Obama-era school lunch nutrition regulations and how they're just terrible and how they make teachers cry, says Christy.
Well, and when I was a kid, certainly I could have brought a sack lunch if I wanted to. We had the money to bring a sack lunch. School lunch, if you got pizza day, that was exciting for everyone, but you had to put a napkin on top of the pizza to soak up all of the grease.
It was a lot of
carbohydrates and a lot of fat, and we loved it. But the regulations put out by the Obama administration made it so that grains had to be 100% whole grains. There was a limit to the amount of salt you could get. There was a limit to the amount of meat you could get. And they did this, I believe, in part. They were combating two things, because once they started putting soda machines in schools – They started opening up school lunchrooms to, you know, Taco Bell and things like that. Kids weren't getting as healthy. Not that I don't like me some Taco Bell and some soda, but sometimes this is the best meal this kid's going to get during the day, and it is taxpayer funded. So they wanted to make sure if your kid was eating school lunches that they were getting healthy school lunches within guidelines that were made by people that understand healthy guidelines.
Right.
And so Christy wants to make it so that you can use, you don't have to, you know, you can put half white flour in with your whole wheat. Again, fine at home, but, and in South Dakota, I don't know that there are food deserts in South Dakota per se, but as a national program, there are kids that don't have access to good grocery stores, for God's sakes, much less a piece of fresh fruit, much less a piece of whole grain food. And the school lunch program makes it possible for them to have access to that food, as does the breakfast program. And as you pointed out, healthy food makes for smarter students. That's in the article that you put in your blog.
Yeah, there's new research, and we'll have the link under the post here in a little bit. But there is research where they studied schools responding to the Obama nutrition rules. And those schools, it was in California, schools that sought out more nutritious vendors saw their test scores go up. Mm-hmm. I mean, you can't fight that. The kids get healthier food. They get more fruits and vegetables. And that was a key part of the nutrition guidelines. They cut down the things you talked about, Spencer.
Right.
But they also made more available this, you know, in some schools, unlimited servings of, you know, your carrots, your broccoli, your cauliflower.
Right.
Now, you may not like cauliflower, but hey, it's good food and kids can learn to like it.
Yeah.
And it's good for you. So there's nothing wrong with that. Matter of fact, there's a lot right with giving kids healthy food that helps them learn better.
And aren't we going through an obesity epidemic in this country? Isn't that a huge problem with our children?
Certainly.
Our kids are kind of fat, or are fat and are not getting super smart. So...
Yeah, whatever the impacts, you can't complain about giving kids healthy food. And for Christy to turn from a budget question that talks about actually taking away funding for food programs and education programs, right, to turn that back to complaining about rules that require healthy food in schools, kind of sneaky.
Well, yeah, you still have the option to send your kid to school with a bag of cheese and meat. You can totally do that.
Absolutely. If you want to send them with beef jerky, you can do that. Enjoy.
So there you go. Let's move on to the next one. Okay, there was an article written by a gentleman named Sam Anderson, whose work I am not familiar with, so I'm basing everything I know about him simply on this article. And he did the good, he did the right thing. He put his kids on a plane and brought them to South Dakota to go on vacation, like good people do and should continue to do.
Keep those sales tax dollars coming, tourists.
And he went, they had a 4-hour layover in Minneapolis, so they went, and this is where I already get a little ruffled. And I'm not a super, like, regionalist, and I'm a comedian, so I make fun of all of this stuff, but I'm one of us, so I get to. But he described the entrance to Mall of America as grubby. And it is not grubby, sir. It is not. And he accurately described it as a mall within a mall within a mall. But guessing based on what he said about his kids later in the article, I'm guessing his kids loved the Mall of America. He didn't mention how they responded to it, but it's full of bright lights and toys and products and consumerism. And I'm guessing they love that.
Hey, who wouldn't love that?
And then they get to South Dakota. He rents the biggest SUV he can get. He felt the roads were a little narrow, which I don't under. I guess I don't know what roads he was on, and I don't drive the biggest SUV I could find. But he's also used to driving in New York, so.
In the Black Hills in March, I don't question the wisdom of having a good four-wheel drive vehicle to carry your stuff around.
Absolutely.
Probably a good choice.
Absolutely. He felt that, rightfully so, that Mount Rushmore is kind of a big monstrosity that is somewhat ridiculous. And I would even go so far as to say, as if we were making Mount Rushmore today with the sensibility it took to make Mount Rushmore, then they would be bobbleheads. I think they would all shake a little bit. It's a big ego move. I mean, I, and again, they're not the pyramids, but they're kind of the pyramids. There's that kind of same sentiment of like, I'm going to make something really big that people are going to know forever so that you can remember me. I'm not saying that kings were buried in Mount Rushmore, but it kind of comes from that same place of that, like, yeah, this is big. Oh, this is big.
It combines the traditional human urges to A, do huge things, and B, do things to nature that write their name on nature. You know, it's kids carving their initials on a tree. We want to last. We want to make our mark. That's what Mount Rushmore does, writ large.
And that's what people do. I guess his opinions on Mount Rushmore are fine. I mean, he said, and I do like the way he put that. Like, it's not the bigness of Mount Rushmore; it's the bigness of the area around it when you put Mount Rushmore next to it.
That's a really good point, Spencer. Because there, my friend Joe Lowe, who he ran for governor a couple years ago, he used to be state fire chief. Now he runs an art gallery in Rapid City. Mm-hmm. He's also a photographer. And one of the greatest pictures I've ever seen of Mount Rushmore, he took, and I actually saw this up in Larry Pressler's office, so everything's connected to this picture.
Right.
Joe Lowe's photo of Mount Rushmore is this beautiful aerial shot that shows the faces, but then it spans out and shows all of Mount Rushmore, the actual natural formation. So you see these enormous faces, tiny in the context of what is still a massive natural rock. And it really, I thought that captured just what you said perfectly, showing this huge human structure still dwarfed by the wonder of the mountain and of the Black Hills surrounding it.
And he's right. And, you know, my wife and I went there on our honeymoon last summer. I've been a couple of times, but she had never been. And it's awesome. It's huge. It's ridiculous. The way they built it is ridiculous. The whole idea was ridiculous. You know, the pitch for Mount Rushmore was, we're going to put some heads on a mountain. And they were like, how are you going to do it? And he's like, we'll figure it out. Just give us some money. And they did. And they figured it out. And the whole thing, it's an engineering marvel. I mean, is it the best use of space? I don't know, but it's there. It already happened. You know what I mean? I guess there was a couple other things that bothered me about the article, though. It's like, all we could find in Custer was a Pizza Hut. And I'm like, well, use Yelp, sir. The Black Hills are full. Like, again, we did our honeymoon there. We found amazing food in the Black Hills. And we had some great, buffalo steaks. We had some buffalo ribeyes that were just fantastic. Mm-hmm. And we found good pizza. We found good ice cream. We found, you know, you just have to look a little tiny bit. You know, and Deadwood is a little ridiculous. It's a big, you know, it's very Vegas-y, but like Spearfish is really laid back. And I think Sioux City is also, not Sioux City, Rapid City.
Rapid, yep, other side.
And he was there in the middle of winter, so I understand why he was dead. But if you listen to this and read the New York Times, and that's what you base your tourism choices on, so that's a lot of people, I'm sure, give it a shot in the summer.
And although the thing is, even, you know, his choice to come in March, some could say, well, you're not seeing Mount Rushmore at its height. You're not experiencing the whole vibe, you know, when you're there in July and there are tourists from all over the world thronging about, which itself is fun.
Right.
Mount Rushmore is fun, not just for itself. Like, I've gone several times.
Right.
Once you've seen it several times, then it's fun to kind of not look at the mountain, turn around and look at all the people.
No, exactly. When we were there, it was packed, and it was such a broad cross-section of people who had come from continents away that go directly here to be like, wow, that's rad.
And there's metaphor upon metaphor that one could make about now the power of this work of art to bring others to see it, and then the people who see it become art, and oh my gosh, then we're an artwork in an artwork in an artwork, just like the Mall of America.
Right.
But there's an argument to be made that, you know, going to Mount Rushmore or Custer or anywhere in the Black Hills in the off season, go in March, go in January, go any of those times and have the hills to yourself, that can be a treasure if you recognize what a treasure is.
Right.
Like even Harney Peak. I've been up that several times as well. And usually it's very busy, very popular. Greatest hike I ever had up to Harney Peak was, it was in April, but there had just been like a 2-foot snowstorm. I had the trail entirely to myself all the way up.
Oh, nice.
Absolutely beautiful. And you don't get that much. You don't get to experience the Black Hills the way they would have been a long time ago before we started blowing up mountains and digging up gold and putting up bobbleheads and wineries and, you know, crazy touristy stuff all around. So really, the Black Hills offer something wonderful any time of year if you're willing to look for it.
Well, and there, and it is a great combination of like kitschy, you know, of kitschy 1950s era American tourism, coupled with they're updating things all the time. You know, the restaurant across from the bed and breakfast we stayed at was Hawaiian fusion, so that's just fantastic. And there is a lot of wine. I'm doing a show at a winery in May, and they're doing some really. I don't drink myself, but my wife was very excited about the wines that they were making. They've got a little bit for everybody, and if you look, you'll find something you like. You know, that's what the internet is for. So again, of the millions of New Yorkers that listen to this podcast, please give us another chance. If you look, you'll find, and there is a lot of untouched stuff. And again, Mount Rushmore is kind of a ridiculous testament to what people are capable of. And New Yorkers, let us not forget, you gave us Donald Trump. If you want to speak of monstrosities that
keep him off the mountain, we will not be adding a fifth face.
And don't make any more of those. We can't afford that either. Okay, let's move on. Speaking of tourism, we were having a little trouble right now because we don't apparently have enough people to do all the work that you need to do.
That's right, Spencer. This has come up in the news now. It's been mentioned before, but in the last couple weeks here, we've seen a surge of kind of mentions in the press from Senator Mike Rounds and from others talking about how agriculture, tourism, even the construction industry, three big industries in South Dakota, are having trouble getting workers, in part because of restrictions on immigration.
Well, there's not enough H-2B visas.
H-2B,
which
right?
They cap out. There's and I have the actual number. Very quick, here's a couple of stats that I'm just going to throw out here. First of all, South Dakota has an unemployment rate that hovers around 4%, which is low. Congratulations.
Oh, I think we're at 3%, maybe below that right now in South Dakota. But yeah, traditionally, if we're above 4%, that's surprising.
So an H-2B visa means that you can come in, you do seasonal work, and then you go back, and it's legal, and everybody's documented, and everybody's taken care of. They capped it out at X number, and I apparently, what do they usually just grant more?
Yeah, in the past, Congress has acted to say, oh, we'll make an exception this year. Oh, we'll make an exception again to allow more people in. But they haven't done it yet for the current H-2B program. So here we are in March, and the federal government's saying, oh, we've already granted all the H-2B visas we have available for 2017.
So quick couple of numbers here. The annual number of H-2B employers typically ranges from 50 to 100. And the number of H-2B jobs fluctuates between 1,000 and 1,300.
Is that just in South Dakota?
That's in South Dakota.
Wow, okay.
The wages span from around $9 an hour for low-end hospitality work to about $24 an hour for high-end construction work. So before winning approval to hire HB2 workers, employees must show evidence that they are not there are not enough U.S. workers for the jobs, and that the employment of H2B workers will not adversely affect the wages and working conditions of similarly employed U.S. workers. So they're not coming for your jobs. It's that we don't have enough people.
Right.
Now, I know there is unemployment in other states. I don't know if they can figure out a way to make some kind of a state transfer kind of thing. But as you pointed out, too, a lot of these guys pay on the low end. And it's a lot of jobs that people – I mean, they're not full-time – they're not year-round jobs. It's,
right.
It's a temporary fix. And if you come here, make money, and go to some place where there's a dollar difference, where the peso isn't worth as much as the dollar, so American dollars are worth more, so that pays off for you if you're from Mexico.
Yeah, and tourism is an industry that really shows the difficulty. Because like you said, Spencer, we're talking about jobs that are – you know, they're 40 hours a week, maybe more, but they're just in the summer. They're – 4 months, 5 months, whatever, you know, for your regular worker, anybody with a family, they can't just drop everything, go take this job for 4 months, and then come back home and hope they get a different job. Most, you know, residents, most South Dakotans are looking for steady work. And so for tourism, you've got to look at people who are free to work just in the summertime. Mm-hmm. That's your students,
right?
High school, college, whatever. That's, you know, maybe some other people are looking for part-time stuff, but then it's foreigners, immigrants, and again, people looking for a chance to come to America even for a little bit and make some money.
And because of the structure that we have in place, we have proven that we just don't have enough Americans that want this job. So to me, what this sounds like to me, excuse me, is if they don't figure out a way to make this work, is people will start employing illegal immigrants. And then, you know, it's to me, this is the same as drugs and prostitution. You know, if you make them legal, then you can regulate them. You can keep an eye on them. You know what's going on. You can make sure everybody's safe. You can also collect tax dollars off of it. If you make it illegal, now suddenly you've got people, you've got workers that are being exploited. You've got taxes that aren't being paid. You've got people that are not being paid enough money. And if the workers witness something, they're not going to say anything because they don't want to get deported.
And that can kind of lead us to talking about agriculture, because in tourism, you've got mostly seasonal work, mm-hmm. and we've got the H-2B program to, mm-hmm. You know, bring workers in. Agriculture can bring workers in those programs as well.
Right.
But I've read and heard, you know, agricultural leaders saying, well, look, we still, like with dairies, those aren't seasonal. Those are year-round
right.
affairs. And even the dairies apparently can't pay the wages that make people want to come and milk cows 7 days a week,
right.
every week of the year. Because
right.
cows don't take a vacation, neither can the milkers.
Right.
And so they've come to rely, the dairies have, well, they rely on illegal immigration.
Mm-hmm.
They represent exactly the arc you're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
If they can't get legal immigration, you know, the legal visas, they'll take whatever workers they can get.
Right.
That's a problem. And I mean, I'm not sure how to resolve it, but I've heard the agriculture industry even say we could get behind immigration reform that would allow undocumented workers
right.
to, you know, not get citizenship, but at least stay in the country, essentially
right.
kind of a quasi-amnesty.
Mm-hmm.
Big Ag is willing to say our workforce situation is so desperate, we can't wait for local folks to make enough babies to work in our dairies. We need to hire the Mexicans and, you know, Latin Americans and folks from elsewhere who are willing to come and do the work for the wages we can afford.
So xenophobia is very popular this year, and fear of the other is very popular, and fear of immigrants is very popular this year. But as we were talking about last time, when the rubber hits the road and it starts to be about money and it starts to be about people's businesses, you start to see cracks in the facade of, you know, basically just the ideas that the right is putting forth. You know, you can build the wall, but we still need people to get through the wall so that our economy continues to function.
Right. We need workers to do the
yeah.
jobs, whether we're talking about scrubbing out the toilet at the KOA
right.
out in Custer or, you know, Palmer Gulch, or whether we're talking about people coming to the dairies up and around
sure.
here, you know, and along the I-29 corridor to milk cows every day, or whether we're talking about the hundreds of people right now as we speak who are chopping up cattle down at the Demcota plant
sure.
south on the south edge of Aberdeen. We need people to do those jobs. We've got unemployment of a little more than 2% in Aberdeen.
Yeah.
There aren't enough idle people, right. Well, except for maybe you and I, Spencer, as we sit here with these microphones doing a podcast.
I am not idle. I had a very good year, to be honest with you. I do plenty, and I'm not looking to get into the butchery business.
Exactly. You've got enough work.
I'm doing just fine.
I would speculate that, you know, comedy is better, more enjoyable work than chopping up cows.
Absolutely. And, you know, it kind of is like the arts. Not only do I get paid, but I help the economy because people come out, they buy tickets to my show, they buy drinks, they, you know, buy food. So this employs cooks and bartenders, bar owners, people had to buy gas to get there, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It all works together. I don't know why I have to defend myself all of a sudden, but I'm gainfully employed and right. I really enjoy what I do. And I hope everybody gets the opportunity to do that. Not that I haven't washed dishes in my life, and I've been a line cook. I used to work at a Perkins third shift by myself, and I had to hustle. You know, it's been a long road to get to where I'm at.
Sure,
and
I've
put in plenty of back-breaking hours. Well, and you know, and that's an example too. I know immigrants who have come here. I used to work with a kid. He's not a kid anymore, but he was a dishwasher from Ecuador in Minneapolis, and now he's the head chef at some really nice restaurants in Minneapolis. You know, it's mm-hmm. that's the American dream. He worked his way up and is doing great for himself now.
Yeah, and people come here for that. Mm-hmm. And you know, people who are here, I mean, that's kind of why the American workforce is where it is. You know, our immigrant parents, grandparents, great-grandparents who came here at whatever point in the 19th or 20th century, they came and made their living in the earth or made their living in the factories. And now, you know, more Americans have reached a point where that's, you know, either those jobs aren't around
right.
or they've got other jobs and other skills that they're not going to go chop up cows every day.
Right.
And there aren't enough of us left to do that. We don't want to do it. We don't want to go pick, you know, crops. We don't want to go pick
right.
broccoli for the wages that are being offered in the
right.
industry, but we do want to eat.
Right.
And so the industry is left going well if there's not enough local population to fill these jobs, because they do all have gainful employment in other
right.
ways. Everybody
right.
who wants to work pretty much can work.
Mm-hmm.
What are we going to do? You have to go get the labor.
Yeah. Well, and the good news, I guess, is Trump is going to be in jail soon, and then we're just going to reevaluate all of these policies and come up with more reasonable answers.
We can hope so. We can hope so, because it's beyond politics, and it's not like this has just come up this year with Trump. Here in Brown County, we've been talking about this for years, that, you know, our population is aging. We're not having as many kids.
Right.
There are not as many people in that, you know, 24 to 54 prime working years demographic, however you break that down. But we've got as many people around who need as much work done. They need their houses cleaned.
Mm-hmm.
They need their lawns mowed, their roads paved,
right.
their tourist attractions staffed, whatever. I mean, you don't have workers, you got to go get them. If
That's
we're
right.
not making workers, we got to get workers from overseas.
That's exactly right. And we got to pay them. And if we could get some universal health care, they would also benefit. You know, it would be good for the workers.
Hey,
everybody would win.
Cheaper for everybody.
That'd be fantastic. So, you know, we talk to each other a lot, and I think we agree for the most part on a lot of things, but I think there's something to be said for talking to people that you maybe don't see eye to eye on with everything, and so that's what we did this week. Why don't you tell us about our guest?
You bet. Representative Drew Denner, youngest man in the legislature, was willing, not just willing to talk to us, but willing to hustle right back here to Dakota Free Press World Headquarters on veto day, the day the legislature finished its business in Pierre, came right back, sat down for a couple of really good conversations. I've already posted his conversation with us about veto day, the issues taken up this week. Drew sat down with us then for a longer conversation about some bills that took place during the legislative session. How are you doing today, Drew?
I'm doing well, thank you.
Great, glad to have you here in the studio. We're going to talk about the legislative session in general. How was it? Just general impression.
You know, it was probably about what I expected. Certainly it was my first time actually being a legislator. I'd been around the process enough, you know, both, you know, my grandfather was there from the time I was very young, and then I interned, you know, made some good friends up in the legislature, you know, prior to this year. So it was certainly a process I'd been around a lot. I think the one thing that probably got to me the most is you realize that, you know, when you got elected, you're representing a lot of people, and, you know, these people, you know, care about the issues, and they should. So you're receiving a lot of input from your constituents, and you have to do your very best to communicate with your constituents and to, you know, do everything you can to take the will of the voters and try to put it into legislation. So it means a lot to me when I have, you know, feedback from someone, anyone really, but especially a constituent here from Aberdeen, you know, saying vote yes on this bill, vote no on that bill. That really means a lot to me. And that was probably the biggest thing that was new to me being a legislator.
So tell me, we'll get into bills in a moment, but just as maybe advice to people young or old who might be thinking about getting involved in the legislature, running and serving, what's the one most important thing you would recommend to a new person to the legislature that they should do to get ready for the actual work that you do in Pierre?
I would say listen to both sides of the story, because I don't care what issue it is, there are going to be two, three, many sides to an issue. So take an issue and look at it with an open mind, the pros, the cons. Don't just make up your mind right away if you don't have to. Listen to both sides of the story. Do your very best job to represent your district, to represent your thoughts, what you told the voters what you would do. And also, a big thing for me is make sure that something's constitutional before you vote for it or against it.
Great. Well, let's talk about some of the bills that you had to apply that listening and that both sides paradigm to. First one that you sponsored, your first big bill, House Bill 1088, which had to do with, as I understand it, adding railroad track equipment. Not just the trains, but their trucks that run on the rails to the things that we drivers need to yield to.
Yeah.
What motivated that bill?
So that bill, that idea actually came from an Aberdeen resident, Tim Even, who actually ran for the state house, I don't know if it was probably 6 or 8 years ago, give or take.
He's one of those Democrats, isn't he?
He is a Democrat.
I've heard that about him.
But he had a good idea here, and they had some issues. Obviously, when you're driving along the road and you see a train coming along the track, you say, you know what, I'm probably going to stop for this, or I'm going to get smushed by this train. Not only am I going to get pulled over, but that train might hit me. So you know, let's stop for this. We've had some issues, and this is what I heard from Tim and some others actually as well, where this maintenance equipment on the tracks, it certainly can stop much quicker than a train, but it's not a Prius. It can't stop immediately. You know, it'll take it a minute. So
yeah, they've got those big heavy metal wheels and stuff.
They do.
They're still big equipment.
So the statute didn't cover that. The statute said you need to stop for trains, not any other maintenance equipment. So now what this bill did is it said you have to stop for maintenance equipment on the tracks, which only makes sense. That bill passed, I believe, with just one no vote out of, you know, both the House and the Senate. So it will it was signed by the governor, and it will take effect July 1st. So now if you're driving after July 1st, if you're driving along the highway and you see some maintenance equipment on the tracks coming at you on the road, you know, just take a stop and wait for it to go by.
Now, you mentioned that, I looked at the record. There was one nay, only one. Committee, floor votes, whatever. There was one nay, and that was Representative Pischke from down in Del Rapids. You talked about seeing both sides of an issue, but it sounded like almost everybody agreed on this one. Yeah, stop for the maintenance truck on the track. What was Pischke's deal?
You know, Pischke is a good friend of mine. And I think he was just giving me a hard time on my first bill.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah. So even he didn't really mind stopping for the equipment on the tracks.
I don't think he was just too opposed to it.
All right. So he'll be okay with that. He respects the rail guys just as much as the rest of us.
I think we'll be good to go on him.
That's a relief. Let's talk about another bill that you were involved with as a co-sponsor. That was Senate Bill 128. Now, this one had to do with alcohol. And as a confirmed teetotaler, I know nothing about alcohol.
Okay.
Tell me what 128, what great problem of the day this bill was solving.
Okay. So Senate Bill 128. 28 is a response to a little bit of an issue we've had here in South Dakota. So for years, there have been charitable events where the manufacturers, the wholesalers, they will show up and they will pour their wine or their beer at these events.
The alcohol manufacturers.
Correct.
We're not talking the tractor factory serving beer. We're talking beer makers serving beer.
Yeah, we're talking the beer, the wine, the manufacturers, the wholesalers.
Sure.
So they'll show up at these events, these charitable events, and they will pour their beverages. And, you know, they'll tell people, you know, if I were a beer manufacturer, I would pour you a beer and tell you about it, or a wine. So the wholesalers didn't really like doing it because they had to commit a lot of staff. They were showing up at, you know, all these small towns. They were showing up at the large towns. And here in Aberdeen, there's an event called Grape Times. In Sioux Falls, there's one called the Big Grape. And these are wine events, and they bring in a lot of money. Like the one here in Aberdeen goes to Safe Harbor is the charity. So then there's the smaller town events, and that's probably primarily beer. So what the wholesalers contacted the Department of Revenue and said, you know, take a look at the current statute. We don't think we can legally pour our beverages ourselves.
Uh-huh.
And Department of Revenue took a look at the statute and said, you know what? You're right. You're not allowed to do this. And this
why is, on earth not?
I don't know. This is a law that was passed. I don't remember what year, but it was quite a long time ago.
Okay.
And they said, you can't do that. So the manufacturers and the wholesalers of alcohol had to stop pouring. So many of these charitable events were just canceled, just done. So what this bill said originally says manufacturers and wholesalers may pour, assist in the pouring or serving of their beverages at all of these charitable events. So the wholesalers, still the manufacturers, they're the little guys. They're hungry. They want to get out and they want to pour their beverages and they want to sell beverages. They want to educate people about their beverages. So they are all about it. But the wholesalers, and I understand, they have to put a lot of money into this and they have to dedicate mm-hmm. a lot of staff. Mm-hmm. It was actually, they told me the numbers and it was way more than you'd think. It cost them a lot of money to do this. They didn't like it. So over on the Senate side where they started, they actually amended out wholesalers. So it said only the manufacturers can. So then that passed the Senate. I want to say it was unanimous, but I'd have to look to know for sure. I think it was unanimous. It comes over to the House, and we said we want it to be everybody. Let's let people do what they want to do. Let's mm-hmm. pour their beverages. So in House Judiciary, we amended it saying the wholesalers could also pour. Okay? The wholesalers, again, didn't like it, but we passed it to the House, I believe, with just 4 no votes. So it went back over to the Senate, and the Senate actually appointed a conference committee because the wholesalers, they wanted it changed. So we took it to a conference committee, and we needed to work out a compromise. They weren't happy, and you know I would have liked the bill just passed as it was written, you know, originally or how it came out of the House. But there clearly was not support for that. You know, some of the members on the conference committee were said, you know, either to amend it or we're going to kill the bill, which I didn't want the bill killed.
It's a high moment of tension there, yeah.
Yeah, so what we came up with, and it was actually an idea I had, how about we let manufacturers pour or serve any of their beverages, and then the wholesalers can pour or serve wine. And that was an interesting compromise that we had, because the wholesalers, you know, they don't mind showing up to these wine events because there's a lot less of them. Their bigger dog in the fight was they didn't want to show up, you know, at all these little towns. They didn't want, you know, because, you know, there's a lot of small towns in South Dakota. So the compromise we reached is so they could pour wine. So you're going to allow, you know, Safe Harbor to have their fundraiser here. And Safe Harbor, actually, here in Aberdeen, has raised over $250,000 at this event in the last 10 years. So easy math tells you that that's about $25,000 a year on average. So getting this bill passed is going to allow organizations like Safe Harbor to raise, give or take, $25,000 a year.
Sure, so which they've been doing.
Yeah.
But we just realized, oh my gosh, technically that's been illegal since Adam invented grapes.
Exactly.
And so the regular citizen isn't going to notice anything because of this bill. They're still going to have their events. They're going to get their free glass of wine or their $5 glass of wine, whatever it is, and life will be good.
The law is very similar to what we thought it was all along. And this bill, you know, the Department of Revenue wanted this change, but this also came from a constituent here in town, and it was a couple, and they said to me, yeah, these events are getting shut down. Hey, you're a legislator, can you change this?
Fix it, right?
And I said, you know what, that seems like a good idea. I'll do what I can. And we got up to Pierre and session started and we got this bill going.
And you fixed it.
And we fixed it. So that was, I was very pleased to see this fixed so that organizations can have their charitable events.
Now, let me ask you about this fix. So I understand, yes, there were charitable events hinging on this. This bill did have an emergency clause. There's been some talk about the emergency clause this session. You know, one of the precedents is emergencies mean there's either an imminent threat to public safety or health and welfare, or the state's running out of money.
Sure.
Tell me how Senate Bill 128 constitutes an emergency.
So, interesting question. The reason why an emergency clause was put back on this bill is because all laws take effect on July 1st. What the case was is we had quite a few events in like June and May and April, and those events would have been illegal without that emergency clause because the law would have not taken effect yet. So that was the intent of putting the emergency clause on, was to include these events that were going to be happening between today and between July 1st, so then they can actually have their events legally now.
But these aren't state events, right?
Correct.
Okay. Well, we'll talk more about the emergency clause at some point, but thanks for explaining that one to us. Let's talk about some other bills. One big one, big ugly monster, Senate Bill 54. This was the campaign finance reform bill.
Yeah.
Came from the Secretary of State, went through numerous iterations based on IM-22 and then the repeal and, oh my gosh, trying to, you know, erase and scratch out and replace. You voted nay the first time on this bill. You went aye on the conference report.
I did. If I remember correctly, you ultimately decided
you were okay with 54. Why the switch?
Well, there were actually some pretty big changes on the conference committee. Mm-hmm. And probably just to be completely honest with you, 54 is one where if I had it back in front of me, I probably would change to a no today. The reason why I supported it is because on the campaign, I told people, I said, and I guess let's go back a little bit. Candidates in South Dakota are required to file a pre-general campaign finance report, mm-hmm. no matter what.
Just like a couple weeks before the election.
Yeah, so people know who's funding you. That's only fair.
Mm-hmm.
So what happens for the primary is, for example, I had a primary last year. So I had to file a pre-primary campaign finance report so people knew where my money was coming from. Only fair. Now, for example, if another candidate did not have a primary.
Well, like your Democratic counterparts last year. They didn't have a primary.
Yes. So, like you, for example, did not have to file a pre-primary report. Mm-hmm. There had been some discussion. There were other candidates who did have a primary. So they had that pre-primary report. But there were other candidates who did not. So what they did is they donated money to candidate A, donated money mm-hmm. to candidate B who did mm-hmm. have a primary. Candidate A did not have a primary, but didn't have to file a report. So we don't know where candidate A, where that money is coming from, which is not fair. So now statewide candidates, regardless of if they have a primary or not, do have to file a pre-primary report.
If you're a candidate, you file in May and you file in October.
Yes.
Got to do it.
And that's for statewide candidates.
For legislature candidates?
And I was disappointed in that. Very disappointed in that because that was something on the campaign I had said very early on. Mm-hmm. I want more transparency. Sure. I want pre-primary reports. So they made an improvement with statewide candidates. Now you have to file. I wish we could go back next year, and this is potential legislation that we very well may see, and I might even bring myself. Let's make it so legislative candidates have to file the pre-primary no matter what. So I had said I'd support, you know, opening it up to the pre-primary reports. And that's ultimately why I did vote for the bill the second time around.
Sure. Now, one thing that stuck out to me about 54 is it allows corporations and labor unions, entities we're calling them in statute, but corporations and labor unions to donate directly to state and legislative candidates. Federal law doesn't allow that. They sure. ban corporate and union donations to federal candidates. Why did South Dakota decide to allow such contributions?
You know,
and how do you feel about that?
Well, and I'm not completely on board with it. I don't have big, big, strong feelings one way or the other. You know, on one hand, you know, let's look at both sides of the issue. On one hand, you're going to say, well, it money is speech, so these organizations should be allowed to donate money. The other is, well, so individuals can already donate, so why should a business have to donate? That could be, you know, easy to lead to corruption. So looking at it either way, I don't have a big, strong feeling. I kind of see both sides to that. There's some good arguments on both sides. I'm not really a big fan of that. That's probably one issue I have with Senate Bill 54, and I think it was germane to the title. It was germane to one title, but I didn't really like it because you probably could call it an omnibus bill. There was, you know, so many different things we were doing with it.
Under the umbrella of campaign finance.
Yeah, I mean,
there's a lot in campaign finance.
There certainly is. I'd like to probably cast a vote on, for example, should we have to have pre-primary reports? Yes. Okay. Should we allow organizations to donate to candidates? Well, let's have a separate debate on that issue. Ideally, I'm going to say let's break those two things apart. And there are a lot more to that bill. But let's break this stuff up and let's have a debate on the merits of each issue, not bundled up in one sack. So, and for that reason, that's probably why if I had it back in front of me right now, I would probably change to a no.
Well, save that tape. You've got Representative Dennert already laying out an agenda for next year's bills. Representative Dennert, let's take a shot at one more bill. Senate Bill 35.
Sure.
This bill is the annual adjustment of the education formula. It adjusts the property tax levies down based on, I think, the old Cutler-Gabriel agreement from the 90s that keeps property tax from skyrocketing. It says, okay, here's how much property values have gone up. Here's how much the mill levy has to go down so we don't break anybody and still get enough money for the schools. There were some other elements of this bill that came into this bill, though, and you voted no both times.
I did vote no.
Now, my evil question is, why do you oppose K-12 funding? My honest question for Representative Dennert is, what about the formula change in 35 did you oppose? And what would you have done differently to make that bill better?
One thing I did appreciate with Senate Bill 35 towards the end is we actually got to the point where we were going to give an inflationary increased education.
Right, because before there was no increase.
Yeah, and a big part of the reason why we have a little bit of an issue or a big issue with education in South Dakota is because for 20 years or probably longer, we didn't really pay attention to it the way we should have. So then we go every single year, we get behind, and then all of a sudden it's, oh, we got a crisis. Let's increase taxes by a half penny.
Which we did last year.
Yeah, and pay the teachers. So that's what we did. We increased taxes, we increased teacher pay. This year we go along and they're saying no increase. I had a problem with that. I talked to a member of the school board here in Aberdeen and I said, what do you think about this? Should we, you know, he said, you know, let's at least get it to an inflationary increase. I was very happy to see that.
It still wasn't much. We're talking a difference from 0% to 0.3%.
It was very, very small. Mm-hmm. I mean, I would have liked to see, you know, a larger increase there. The increase we got was better than a zero, but it still wasn't as good as hopefully what we'd like to see. But it is a lean budget year.
Sure, sure. Now, a big change that I saw in 35 was didn't have to do with the funding formula for K-12, but how we spend that half penny tax that you brought up. Because last year, that money was dedicated a certain percent to K-12, a certain percent to the VOTEX, and a certain percent to property tax relief.
Yeah.
Good third went to property tax relief. As I understand it, Senate Bill 35 gets rid of that property tax relief dedication. Is that correct?
It does for the ag.
Okay, just for agriculture, not for the others.
That's the way I understand it because it goes to the ag diagnostics lab in Brookings.
So how do you feel about that trade-off, Representative Farmer Dennert, who has some ag tax to worry about, I imagine?
I have mixed feelings about that. Because on one hand, we're getting rid of some property tax relief. Whenever you have to tax people more, that's not necessarily a good thing. Mm-hmm. But you're also getting a new lab, which is a good thing. But I had spoke with some people in the ag community, and I guess myself being one, but I'd spoke with both my veterinarian and then just some other farmers and ranchers. And there didn't seem to be a lot of people out in the ag community asking for it, saying we have to have it. I'm not saying it's going to be a bad thing. I'm just saying I'm not really sold either way. I think there's going to be some positives and negatives to that.
Okay, so when the animal science lab down at SDSU, when that's paid off, what happens to this chunk of the half penny sales tax?
So that money is going to, we created an agriculture futures fund.
Ah.
So that money will, unless we change something, it will eternally go into that fund to help with, you know, future agriculture projects. So we'll see what happens with that. It could be bad. It could be good. I guess it just depends what the legislature chooses to do with it.
And as we saw, last year it was supposed to go to property tax relief, and we changed that this year. So who knows what's going to happen with future legislatures.
Yeah.
Are you ready to go for session 2018?
Well, I think I will be. We just got done with this one, but I think we'll be ready to go for 2018.
So first session didn't kill you. You can stand another one.
Yeah, I think so.
All right. Representative Drew Dennert, Republican from District 3 in Aberdeen. Glad to have you with us on Dakota Free Press.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Great interview. Thank you, Corey. And thank you, Drew, for taking the time to sit down and talk to us. So if you want to talk to us, they can email us at
Corey, C-O-R-Y, at DakotaFreePress.com hit our comment section either on the podcast itself or on the blog on Dakota Free Press.
And Roger, I'm reading your comments, and I think I don't know if we're going to be friends, but we might.
We need to get Roger to come up for a guest interview.
I feel like it. I feel like Roger, it's almost like, you know how like when people like each other in elementary school, but they don't know how to show it, so they kind of punch you in the arm? I think maybe Roger wants to make friends, and he's doing it that way. So a couple of things. If you have a topic you want us to talk about, or if you have an issue that's important to you, send that to Corey. If you have questions about anything we've talked about, email us at that same email address. We also put links to everything in the write-up on the blog. So if you want to do your own homework on any of these topics, all that information is there. Let's say you wanted to hang out with some like-minded people. Let's say you wanted to chew the fat. Maybe you feel a little isolated. It's a kind of a red state in South Dakota. Maybe you want to talk to people that share some similar ideas with you. Where would one do that?
One would do that with one or both of us at the Progressive Happy Hour here in Aberdeen, Friday evening, 5 to 7, at the Ward, the lovely Alonzo Ward former hotel, now just wonderful restaurant and bar in downtown Aberdeen.
Also, if you got a couple of bucks and you want to throw them in the tip jar so we can continue to do this podcast, it would be greatly appreciated.
We'll put it to good use.
If you want to know more about me, my name is Spencer Dobson. You can find my comedy at SpencerDobsonComedy.com. And Dakota Free Press blog, he's insane. Every day, like 3 to 4 posts a day, I think.
I do write pretty much every day, so feel free to join that conversation at DakotaFreePress.com.
All right, well, thanks for tuning in.
Thank you, everybody. Have a great week. We'll